A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it is. Look, it's one of those prompts where the situation itself tells you something about how life actually works. He and Hannah have been dealing with a roof leak, a landlord who decided ending the lease was easier than fixing it, a move with a baby, and right as he is about to box up his computer, the server storage that previously failed starts showing degradation again. His point is basically this. When stuff goes wrong, it goes wrong together, and it always picks the worst possible moment. The question is, how do you handle that? Not the idealized version, where you have a binder full of pre-written plans for every scenario, because you cannot predict everything. How do you get good at the art of impromptu disaster recovery when multiple things collapse at once?
He is right that the stacked failure pattern is real. It is not just confirmation bias. The National Institute of Standards and Technology published a framework on cascading failures in complex systems, and one of their core findings is that the most damaging events are almost never single-point failures. They are compound. A roof leak plus a lease termination plus a server degradation plus, in his case, a regional security situation. That is, four distinct domains collapsing simultaneously.
The universe does love a combo deal.
And the psychological response he described, the hands-on head, why now moment, that is what emergency management literature calls the startle effect. Your prefrontal cortex takes a backseat to your amygdala for a few seconds, sometimes minutes. The question is how fast you can get the prefrontal cortex back in the driver's seat, because that is where triage happens.
Let us walk through this. If I'm standing in an apartment with a dripping ceiling, a 7-month-old, a server that is threatening to eat my data, and a lease that is effectively dissolving under my feet, where do I even start?
The first thing is the least satisfying thing. You do nothing for 60 seconds.
That sounds like my general life philosophy, but I suspect you mean intentional nothing.
The military calls it a tactical pause. Firefighters call it size up. The idea is you do not let the urgency of the situation dictate the speed of your response. Urgency is a feeling, priority is a fact, and they are often not aligned.
The roof is leaking, the data is degrading, the landlord is texting, and I am supposed to just stand there?
You are supposed to breathe, and you are supposed to ask one question. Not why now, not whose fault is this, but what is the thing that, if I do not address it in the next hour, makes everything else worse or impossible? That is your single-point critical item. Everything else can wait 60 minutes.
Which, in his case, is probably the server, right? The roof has already been leaking for weeks. The lease situation is bad, but not going to change in an hour. But data degradation is a ticking clock.
And this is where most people get triage wrong. They confuse urgency with importance. The landlord calling you 7 times feels urgent. It is not necessarily important. The server is not calling you at all. It is just silently corrupting blocks. That is the one that needs your attention first.
Silent failure is the worst kind of failure. It is like a sloth with a grudge. You never see it coming.
In his case, he already knew the storage was suspect because it had failed before. So the degradation was not a surprise. It was a known risk that chose that exact moment to activate. Which brings us to the second principle of impromptu disaster recovery. You triage based on irreversibility, not drama. A roof leak is reversible. You can dry out drywall, you can repaint, you can replace ceiling tiles. It is miserable, but it is reversible. A lease termination is reversible. You find a new place, you move. It is terrible timing, but it is reversible. Data loss, if you do not have backups, is irreversible. Once those blocks are corrupted, they are gone. So, in a stack crisis, you protect the irreversible things first, even if they are the quietest problems in the room.
That is a remarkably clarifying framework. Irreversibility is the sorting algorithm. So step 1, tactical pause. Step 2, identify the irreversible threat and neutralize it. What does that actually look like for a degrading server when you're also supposed to be packing boxes?
Minimum viable intervention. You are not doing a full server migration. You are not rebuilding the array. You are doing the smallest thing that stops the bleeding. In his case, that probably means shutting down the server gracefully, pulling the drives, and making sure his backups are current. If the backups are not current, you do an immediate differential backup to an external drive. That is a 30-minute task, not a 3-hour task.
This is where having a cold spare on the shelf actually matters.
But even if you do not have a cold spare, the priority is the same. Preserve the data. The hardware can be replaced later. The data cannot.
He has stabilized the server. The roof is still leaking. The landlord is still useless. And there is a baby who needs a place to sleep tonight.
Now you move to what emergency managers call operational priorities. And this is where you have to be honest about what you can actually control. The landlord's behavior is outside your control. The leak itself, unless you are a roofer, is outside your control. What is inside your control? Your family's immediate safety and comfort, and the logistics of the move.
You bucket the problems into, can I affect this? And is this someone else's problem that I am just feeling responsible for?
That is exactly right. And the landlord problem, at least in the immediate term, is category 2. It is someone else's problem that you are feeling responsible for. You can send the email, you can document the leak, you can notify them in writing that the property is uninhabitable in certain areas. But once you have done that, you have done what you can do. Obsessing over it does not move the needle.
There is a psychological trap here, though. When multiple things are going wrong, the temptation is to try to solve all of them simultaneously. You end up doing 5 things badly instead of 1 thing well.
That is the third principle. You do not parallelize crisis response unless you have a team. If you are one person, or one person plus a spouse who is also holding a baby, you sequence. One thing at a time, in priority order, until each thing is stable enough to be set aside.
Stable enough to be set aside. That is a different standard than soft. You're not fixing everything. You're getting each thing to a point where it will not get worse while you handle the next thing.
The goal in the first 24 hours is not resolution. It is containment. You want to convert each crisis from an active threat into a managed problem. A managed problem can wait. An active threat cannot.
Let us apply this to a specific situation. The server is contained. Data is backed up. System is off. You will deal with it after the move. The roof is contained. You have moved valuables out of the drip zone. Your bucket's down. You have documented everything for the landlord. The lease is contained. You know you need to find a new place. You have started looking, but you are not going to find one tonight. What is left?
The human factors. And this is the part that technical disaster recovery plans almost always overlook. You have a spouse who is also stressed. You have a baby who cannot self-regulate and who picks up on parental stress. You have your own cortisol levels, which are through the roof. If you do not manage the human system, the technical system does not matter.
The fourth principle is, stabilize the humans before you try to stabilize anything else.
And that can be as simple as saying to your spouse, here is what I'm going to do in the next hour. Here is what I need you to do, if anything. And here is what we are not going to worry about until tomorrow. Just verbalizing the plan reduces anxiety for both of you, because uncertainty is what drives panic. A bad plan is better than no plan, psychologically speaking.
A bad plan is better than no plan. I am going to embroider that on a pillow.
It is actually a well-documented phenomenon in survival psychology. People who survive disasters are not necessarily the strongest or the smartest. They are the ones who, in the first 90 seconds, form a mental model of what is happening and what they are going to do about it. The model can be wrong. It can be incomplete. But the act of forming it moves you from the amygdala to the prefrontal cortex.
Which is the whole game, really. Getting out of your lizard brain and back into your thinking brain.
There is a physiological component to this. When you are in a stacked crisis situation, your body is dumping cortisol and adrenaline. Your heart rate is elevated. Your breathing is shallow. You are not thinking clearly because your body is preparing you to fight a bear, not to triage a server failure.
The breathing thing is not just a wellness cliche.
It is not. Slow, deliberate breathing, 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out, activates the parasympathetic nervous system. It tells your body that the bear is not actually here. And you can do this while you are walking across the room to the server. It is not a separate activity. It is something you layer on to the first 30 seconds of your response.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about the difference between urgency and importance, because I think that is where most people, myself included, get tripped up. The landlord is calling. The baby is crying. The server is beeping. The roof is dripping. Everything feels urgent. How do you actually sort that in real time?
There is a tool for this. It comes out of emergency medicine, but it applies to any crisis. It is called the triage sieve. You sort every problem into one of four categories. Category 1. Immediate. This will cause irreversible damage in the next hour if not addressed. Category 2. Urgent. This needs attention within 24 hours but can wait an hour. Category 3. Delayed. This needs attention within days. Category 4. Expectant. This is either already a lost cause or outside your control entirely.
The trick is being honest about what goes in Category 4.
That is the hardest part. People want to put everything in Category 1 because everything feels like Category 1. But if you actually apply the sieve, most things are Category 2 or 3. The server degradation is Category 1. The roof leak, assuming you have moved valuables out of the way, is Category 2. The landlord negotiation is Category 3. The war with Iran, and I am not minimizing it, but for the purposes of your immediate crisis response, is Category 4. You cannot affect it. You can prepare for its effects, but you cannot stop it.
That is a bracing way to think about it. Category 4 is not. This does not matter. It is, I cannot control this, so I am not going to spend cognitive bandwidth on it right now.
Cognitive bandwidth is the scarcest resource in a crisis. Decision fatigue sets in faster than you expect. Every decision you make about something in Category 4 is a decision you are not making about something in Category 1.
Let us say he has done the triage, he has contained the server, he has communicated the plan to Hannah. The baby is fed and asleep. The crisis is not over. He still has to move.
Now you shift from response to recovery. And recovery has a different tempo. Response is about speed and containment. Recovery is about sequencing and sustainability. You are not sprinting anymore. You are running a marathon, and you need to pace yourself.
This is where the move itself becomes the organizing principle, right? Everything else gets scheduled around the move.
The move is the forcing function. It has a deadline, it has logistics, it has dependencies. So you reverse engineer from the move date. What has to happen before the movers arrive? What can happen after? What can happen in parallel because someone else is handling it?
You build slack into the timeline.
You build aggressive slack. If you think packing will take 2 days, you allocate 4. Because in a stacked crisis situation, something else will go wrong. I guarantee it. The truck will be late. The elevator will be broken. The baby will get a fever. You plan for the plan to fail.
Which circles back to something Daniel mentioned in the prompt. The saying, man plans and God laughs. But I think the corollary is, man plans with slack, and God chuckles mildly.
That is actually a useful reframing. The goal of planning is not to predict the future. It is to create enough margin that when the unexpected happens, it does not cascade into a new crisis. Margin is the difference between an inconvenience and a catastrophe.
That is the word. How much buffer do you have before a delay in one area triggers a failure in another? If you have zero margin, every surprise is a crisis. If you have margin, surprises are just surprises.
You can build margin in ways that do not require money or time. It is often just about sequencing. Do the hard thing first when you still have energy. Do the thing with external dependencies early, so if it goes wrong, you have time to recover. Do not leave the thing that requires a clear head until midnight, when you are exhausted.
What does a practical impromptu recovery plan actually look like on paper? Not the theory, but the artifact. If I am in this situation, what am I writing down?
You are writing down 3 things. First, a triage list. Every problem you are aware of, sorted into those 4 categories. Second, a next action list. For each problem in Category 1 and 2, what is the single next physical action you need to take? Not a project plan. The next action. Plug in external drive. Move crib away from drip zone. Send email to landlord documenting leak. Third, a do not do list.
A do not do list. That is interesting.
It is the most underrated tool in crisis management. You explicitly write down the things you are not going to do today. I am not going to research server hardware. I am not going to argue with the landlord on the phone. I am not going to read news about the regional situation. You are giving yourself permission to defer, which reduces the cognitive load of feeling like you should be doing everything.
The do not do list is basically a contract with yourself to stop feeling guilty about the things you are not doing.
Guilt is a huge cognitive drain in a crisis. You feel guilty about the things you are not handling, so you context switch constantly and nothing gets done well. The do not do list gives you a reason to stay focused.
I also think there is a social dimension to this that is worth talking about. When you are in a crisis, people offer to help, and the instinct is to say, "No, we are fine, thank you." That instinct is wrong.
It is catastrophically wrong. Accepting help is a skill, and it requires a specific kind of ask. Do not say, "Let me know if you need anything." That puts the burden back on the person in crisis. Instead, if you are the one in crisis, you say, "Can you pick up dinner and leave it at our door at 6? Or, "Can you watch the baby for 2 hours tomorrow morning?" Specific, time-bound, low-friction asks.
If you are the one offering help, you do not ask open-ended questions. You make specific offers. "I am going to the hardware store. Do you need buckets? I am making extra dinner tonight. Can I drop some off?" The more specific the offer, the more likely it is to be accepted.
There is research on this from Disaster Response. After Hurricane Katrina, one of the findings was that informal networks, neighbors, friends, community groups, were often more effective at delivering immediate aid than formal institutions because they were faster, more flexible, and more context-aware. The same applies at the household level.
You are building a micro-mutual aid network around your crisis.
You do not have to wait until the crisis to build it. The best time to identify who you would call in a crisis is before the crisis. You do not need a formal plan. You just need to know which neighbor has a truck, which friend is good with kids, which family member lives close enough to be there in 20 minutes.
That is preparedness without the prepper aesthetic.
It is not about bunkers and freeze-dried food. It is about relationships and knowing who can do what. That is the most resilient resource you have, and it costs nothing to cultivate.
Let us talk about the server specifically for a minute, because I think it is a useful case study in how technical failures intersect with life crises. The server is degrading. He has already had one failure. What is the actual playbook for stabilizing that in the middle of a move?
The playbook has three phases, and you do them in order regardless of what else is happening. Phase 1, verify your backups. This is non-negotiable. If your backups are not current or not verified, you stop everything and you fix that. Everything else can burn down around you, but if the data is backed up, you can recover. If it is not, you cannot.
Verifying means actually checking that the backup is restorable, not just that the backup job ran.
A backup that has not been test restored is not a backup. It is a hope, and hope is not a disaster recovery strategy.
Hope is not a disaster recovery strategy. That is going on the pillow next to the other one.
Phase 2. If the server is still running and the degradation is incremental, you do a differential backup of anything that has changed since the last full backup, and you shut the system down gracefully. Do not keep it running. Do not try to fix the array while it is live. Shut it down, pull the drives, label them, and set them aside. You will deal with them after the move. Phase 3 is deciding whether the server is even worth rebuilding, or whether this is the moment to migrate to something simpler. If you are moving anyway, and your server hardware is aging and unreliable, this might be the forcing function to consolidate onto a single NAS or even cloud storage, at least temporarily, until your living situation stabilizes.
Do I even need this complexity? Conversation.
Which is a healthy conversation to have. A lot of home lab setups accumulate complexity over time. You add services, you add drives, you add containers, and eventually you have a system that requires more maintenance than you have time for. A crisis is a good moment to ask, what do I actually need this to do, and what is the simplest thing that does that?
There is a broader principle there about decluttering your dependencies before they become liabilities.
That applies to more than servers. It applies to physical possessions when you are moving. It applies to commitments and obligations. A crisis is a forced prioritization exercise. The things that survive the triage are the things that actually matter. Everything else is revealed as optional.
Which brings us back to the landlord situation. That is a different kind of crisis. It is not technical. It is legal and relational. How do you triage a bad landlord when you are also dealing with everything else?
You triage it by compartmentalizing it. The landlord relationship has three tracks. Track 1 is legal. You document everything in writing, you know your rights under local tenancy law, and you do not accept verbal assurances. Track 2 is practical. You mitigate the damage to your belongings and your living conditions, regardless of what the landlord does or does not do. Track 3 is emotional. You do not let the landlord live in your head rent-free.
That last one is the hard one.
It is the hardest one, especially when the landlord is behaving badly. But it is also the most important, because anger and resentment are cognitive drains. Every minute you spend fuming about the landlord is a minute you are not spending on the move, on your family, on the server, on anything that actually moves the situation forward.
What is the practical advice? You send the email, you document the leak, and then you stop thinking about the landlord.
You set a specific time to deal with landlord-related tasks. 10 minutes in the morning, 10 minutes in the evening. Outside of that window, you do not engage. You do not read their messages. You do not compose angry replies in your head. You treat it like a scheduled maintenance window for a system you do not enjoy maintaining.
I like it.
It sounds absurd, but it works. It is the same principle as the do not do list. You are giving yourself permission to not think about the landlord for 23 hours and 40 minutes a day.
I want to zoom out for a second and talk about the meta skill here, the ability to improvise a disaster recovery plan in real time. How do you get better at that? Because you cannot practice for every scenario, but you can practice the skill of responding to novel scenarios.
The best training is low-stakes improvisation. When something small goes wrong, you burn dinner, you miss a bus, you forget an appointment, treat it as a microdrill, run the triage sieve. What is the irreversible thing? What is the next action? What am I not going to do about this? The stakes are low, so you can practice the mental motion without the cortisol.
You're building the neural pathway for triage, so that when the big thing happens, the pathway is already there.
It is the same reason pilots train in simulators. You want the correct response to be automatic, so that when the startle effect hits, your training takes over while your conscious brain is still catching up.
The other piece is post-incident review. After the crisis is over, you go back and ask what worked and what did not.
You do it gently. A lot of people skip the review because it feels like reliving the trauma, or they do it in a way that becomes self-flagellation. That is not helpful. The review should be curious, not judgmental. What surprised us? What took longer than expected? What would we do differently next time? And then you write those answers down somewhere you will actually see them before the next crisis.
Which is the hard part? Nobody reads their own postmortems.
You keep it simple. 3 bullet points. One thing that worked, one thing that did not, one thing you will do differently. That is it. If it is longer than 3 bullets, you will not read it.
I am thinking about the specific flavor of crisis Daniel described, which is the everything at once, worst possible moment kind. And I think there is something in his prompt about the psychological weight of why now that is worth sitting with. Because the why now question is not just rhetorical. It points to something real about how crises compound.
And the answer to why now is usually not mystical. It is causal. The roof leak went unaddressed for weeks, so it got worse. The server had already failed once, so it was on borrowed time. The lease situation was unstable because the landlord was neglectful. These are not independent events. They are connected by neglect, deferred maintenance, and probability.
Why now is actually, why wouldn't it be now? The conditions for failure were all present. They just happened to converge.
That is actually a useful reframe, because it moves you from the universe is targeting me to, I am seeing the consequences of a system that was already fragile. The fragility was there. The crisis just revealed it.
Which is why one of the best things you can do in a calm period is to ask, where am I fragile? Not, where am I going to fail, but where would a failure hurt the most? And then shore that up, even a little bit.
That is the difference between preparedness and paranoia. Paranoia is trying to predict every possible failure. Preparedness is identifying your single points of failure and adding redundancy or margin around them. You do not need to predict the earthquake. You just need to know that your water heater is not strapped to the wall.
If someone is listening to this and they are not currently in a crisis, what is the one thing they should do today?
Check your backups. Actually verify them. Try to restore a file. If you cannot, fix that before anything else.
If someone is listening to this and they are currently in the middle of a stacked crisis,
4 seconds in, 6 seconds out. Then write down the triage list. Category 1, 2, 3, 4. Then do the next action for Category 1. The rest can wait.
That is deceptively simple, but I think it is right. The whole art of crisis response is not about being brilliant. It is about being clear-headed enough to do the obvious thing in the right order.
Being kind to yourself while you do it. The self-criticism can wait. Right now, you are in response mode. Critique mode comes later.
There is one more thing I want to touch on, which is the role of humor in crisis. Not as a coping mechanism in a dismissive sense, but as something that actually helps you think.
There is research on this. Humor reduces cortisol. It creates cognitive distance. When you can make a joke about the situation, even a dark one, you are demonstrating to yourself that you are not completely overwhelmed by it. You are still capable of pattern recognition and play.
When the server starts beeping and the roof starts dripping and the baby starts crying and the landlord starts texting, and you turn to your spouse and say, "Well, at least the floor isn't lava," that is not denial. That is your brain doing a system check and confirming it is still online.
It is a self-test. If you can still be funny, you can still be functional.
We should probably acknowledge that the regional situation he mentioned, the conflict with Iran, the strikes in Lebanon, adds a layer of stress that most disaster recovery frameworks do not account for. It is one thing to triage a server failure and a roof leak. It is another thing to do it while sirens are going off.
That is where the Category 4 designation becomes both practically necessary and emotionally difficult. You are not saying the regional situation does not matter. You are saying that your immediate actions cannot change it, and your family's immediate safety depends on you focusing on what you can change. That is a hard mental discipline, and it takes practice.
It is also where community becomes essential. You cannot do everything yourself. You need to know that someone else is watching the news, that someone else is monitoring the alerts, that you can delegate the vigilance to someone who is not also trying to pack a server.
That is a phrase I have not heard before, but it is exactly right. In a prolonged crisis, you cannot maintain high alert indefinitely. You have to take shifts, and that requires trust and coordination.
The impromptu disaster recovery plan is not just a personal thing. It is a household thing. It is a community thing. The plan is not a document. The plan is a conversation.
The plan is a conversation that starts with, "Here is what I am seeing. Here is what I think we should do. What am I missing?" And then you listen. Because the other person might see something you do not. They might know that the baby has been fussy because of teething, not just the stress. They might have noticed that the leak is slowing down, not getting worse. The plan gets better when more eyes are on it.
That conversation is itself a stabilizing act. Just having it reduces the chaos. Even if the plan is incomplete, the act of making it together reminds you that you are not alone in the situation.
Which is, in the end, the most important thing. The technical details matter. The triage framework matters. The backups matter. But the thing that gets you through is knowing that you are not facing it alone.
To bring this back to the prompt, what does an impromptu disaster recovery plan look like? It looks like a 60-second tactical pause, a triage list sorted by irreversibility, a next action list, and a do not do list. It looks like accepting help, delegating vigilance, and checking your backups before you do anything else. It looks like breathing, and then doing the obvious thing in the right order, and being kind to yourself while you do it.
It looks like knowing that the goal is not to solve everything. The goal is to contain everything, stabilize the humans, and get to tomorrow. Tomorrow, you can solve things. Today, you just need to not lose ground.
That is a good place to land. Contain, stabilize, survive the day. Everything else is tomorrow's problem.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1782, a French cartographer published a map of Central Asia that included a large island in a lake in what is now Kyrgyzstan, labeling it Ile de la Pierre de Tonnerre, or Thunderstone Island. The island never existed. The cartographer had misinterpreted a traveler's description of a large rock formation on the shore as an island. For context, the lake in question, Issyk-Kul, is approximately 113 miles long and 37 miles wide, meaning this phantom island would have been roughly the size of Malta.
A rock on the shore became an island the size of Malta.
I am now wondering how many international treaties were negotiated around islands that were just rocks someone misread. The open question I am left with is this. We have talked about individual and household crisis response, but what does this look like at the community level? if everyone is in a stacked crisis simultaneously, which is what happens in a regional conflict or a natural disaster, how does triage scale? That feels like a whole other episode.
But the principles probably hold. Containment over resolution. And a lot of breathing.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode, including this one, at My Weird Prompts.
If you found this useful, share it with someone who is having a bad week. It might help. We will be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.